You and I back together again, busy show, Thursday, October 7th, 2021, right here on Connecticut Today. We chatted briefly with Jim Capra, campaign manager and treasurer for Shelton Democratic mayoral candidate David Eldridge, on some controversial comments that Mr. Eldridge made decades ago that he does not deny making and he's taking responsibility for, he says. U.S. Supreme Court seems to be upsetting everyone, and that is a good thing, according to our guest, attorney Michael O'Neill from the Landmark Legal Foundation. And finally, Quinnipiac University Associate Professor of Media Studies Kirsten Wesner chimed in on whether or not the big social media companies are essentially untouchable, and she told us about battling a certain someone in trivia, and the guy she used to battle is making national headlines. A longtime Shelton resident, now running for mayor against longtime incumbent Republican Mark Loretti. Comments he made, Mr. Eldridge not running away from, saying, yeah, they were 30 years ago, a different time in my life. I own up to them, and they were unearthed back when it was the Bridgeport Post, from a clipping posted by a gentleman who has been on this show. Kevin Rennie, let's go to the phones, and Jim Capper's on the phone. He, of course, is David Eldridge's campaign manager. Hey, Jim, it's Paul at WICC. How are you?
Hi, good. How are you?
I'm good. Glad you called in. What do you think?
Thank you for giving me the opportunity.
Yeah, well, thanks.
So you can kind of get things more open up in the air. I mean, you know, there's a lot to talk about here.
Mm-hmm.
But I appreciate you bringing out the facts and really talking about what has happened. Dave has taken ownership. He's apologized. I will share with you, though, you mentioned the gentleman, Kevin Rennie.
Yeah.
I'm really disappointed, honestly. You know, I've read his columns in the past, and he really is doing quite a smear campaign against David Eldridge, not bringing out all the facts. He says, you know, Dave is struggling to address this issue. We've addressed this head on. And I truly believe that Kevin is speaking to probably one of Loretti's campaign managers, who I'm not going to mention a name, but he knows who I'm talking about.
Okay, yeah, I prefer
and
you not
to. It's a smear tactic. Yeah, no, of course. But I also want to talk about Dave as a person. I'm a Republican, and I was a Board of Aldermen member for 2 terms. You know, Dave, even though he's running as a Democrat, he has Republicans running his campaign, because after 30 years of Marco Loretti, this gentleman is not a Republican. This is the way he runs the city, the way he treats people. It's a dictatorship. The way he's running it is pure negligence. And I can't sit on the sidelines and know what I know about Mark Loretti, let him do this anymore. And I can go on, like, you know, on News 12, the chief, Sean Sakura, made a comment that he holds the, you know, there's great conduct at the police department. We hold up to pride and higher standards. That's the biggest bunch of baloney I've ever heard in my life. I'll share with you a quick story. If you have a minute, I'll tell
well,
you.
Well, I'm a little tight time-wise, so let me just ask you this. So, Jim, you are convinced then that Mr. Eldridge is taking this on as best he can? It certainly seems that way from the comments I read. 30 years ago, you're saying it's time to move on.
Correct. And I would ask you this. How could he have handled it any better? He handled it with class, grace, and mature. And I think the voters in Shelton have seen that, and they've been nothing but receptive and kind and supportive to Dave.
All right. Jim Capper, thanks for calling in. Jim, we appreciate the time, and thanks for being there.
All right. Thank you.
Appreciate it. All right. There's James Capper. He is running the campaign of longtime Shelton resident, retired police officer David Eldridge, running in a little bit of a testy, and those are the best kind, though. He hard-fought campaign against longtime Shelton incumbent mayor Mark Loretti. Folks here in Connecticut, Fairfield, New Haven County, all over the state, also watch what's going on in D.C. As far as the U.S. Supreme Court is concerned, some pretty high-profile cases, a lot of them usually centering around things like property rights, gun rights, abortion, and all that. And our next guest, we've had this gentleman on before, attorney Michael O'Neill. He serves as Assistant General Counsel in the Barbara K. Olson Legal Counsel at the Landmark Legal Foundation. Wrote an interesting piece the other day in The Hill saying, you know, this current makeup of the Supreme Court is interesting and maybe a little unpredictable. Mike, it's Paul here at WICC. Good to have you on again. How are you?
I'm doing great, Paul. It's a great pleasure to be on. Thank
well,
you.
Thank you. Great to have you back. And this Supreme Court, Mike, I guess, is upsetting people on the left, upsetting people on the right. So I don't know, Mike, I guess like a good baseball umpire, what do they say? If you're upsetting 50% of the people 50% of the time, you're doing your job, right or wrong?
Well, I think so. And as you know and your listeners know, this week the Supreme Court began its term. First Monday in October, it's traditional beginning of its term for the 2021 and 2022 year. And the left has its knives out. The left has spent essentially the better part of this year trying to bring pressure onto the court. The president has commissioned a panel to explore expanding the court to 13 members. Prominent Democrats, Senator Schumer, Senator Whitehouse, or Senator Schumer famously said earlier this year that the court will reap the whirlwind if it decides Roe versus Wade in a way that he disagrees with or the left disagrees with. Senator Whitehouse has called for investigations into the judiciary. And you have the media, of course, that are making the allegations. You see a lot of the people, and this was actually the point of my piece that I wrote, is you have a lot of, you know, your so-called mainstream media calling the court a partisan political apparatchik of the Republicans or the conservative movement. And all you have to do is look at the recent history and see that those claims really don't hold a lot of water. And I talk about that in my article. And, you know, and just looking forward, if you look at some of the cases that they've held just last couple of terms, you realize that they really have. They've gone cut both ways. I mean, they upheld Obamacare yet again last term. There was another, you know, the big, huge movement on the conservative side to overturn Obamacare. It percolated all the way up to the Supreme Court again the last term. And they upheld it. They found a way that, you know, Justice Roberts found a way to upheld it. A couple terms ago, they extended the Civil Rights Act to gays and transgenders. Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, which was never intended to apply to those individuals. I'm not saying that those individuals shouldn't have protections or shouldn't be considered protected classes, but the bottom line is the law was never intended to apply to those folks. Supreme Court ruled it did. Supreme Court also shot down attempts to challenge the 2020 presidential election. They also ruled against Trump and said that he had to turn over his financial records to the New York District Attorney or to the Southern District of New York prosecuting attorneys who were looking into him. So, you know, claims that it's a partisan body really aren't holding a lot of water.
Mike, hang on. Fascinating subject. Sure. Mike O'Neill, Landmark Legal Foundation. We'll talk more with him about the Supreme Court. First, traffic and weather together. 3:36 on WICC. And we welcome back for a return visit here. He's been a guest with us a few times before from the Landmark Legal Foundation. Attorney Michael O'Neill, he serves as Assistant General Counsel and the Barbara K. Olson Legal Counsel at the Landmark Legal Foundation. His op-ed was published, posted yesterday in The Hill. The Supreme Court is not political, and reversing Roe v. Wade would not make it so. Mike, along with things like abortion and other hot-button issues, it's interesting because if people on both sides, Mike, would just take a breath, down through history, we see Supreme Court justices appointed by both major parties, right and left, Republican and Democrat, Mike, who are supposed to be slam dunks for their party. And then some of these justices, they are, Mike, but then some of them get up there and all of a sudden the people who are popping the champagne on the Republican side or the Democratic side, sometimes, Mike, they're in for a rude awakening as to how these justices actually view cases once they're on the high court.
Well, that's exactly right. And I think, and I mean, I'm going to be a little armchair predictive here. I think that it's going to be interesting to see with the abortion case this term, because the rubber really is going to meet the road in this case. You've seen, you know, Justice Roberts and Justice Kavanaugh kind of take narrow positions, take minimalist positions in some of these cases, like the ones I was discussing before, you know, the ACA, the Obamacare challenge last term, for example. You saw Justice Roberts really take a very narrow exception to upholding the Obamacare, but he still upheld it. But the rubber really is going to meet the road with this case. And what I'm trying to say here is with overturning Roe versus Wade, it is not a political decision. What happened was back in the early 1970s, when Roe versus Wade came down, and then later Planned Parenthood v. Casey in the 90s, that is the Supreme Court inserting itself into the political process. And reversing those two cases is actually returning the issue into the political realm. So originally, it was the decision of state legislatures on how to regulate abortions. And to some extent, state legislatures still have some authority to regulate abortions. But overturning Roe and overturning Planned Parenthood versus Casey will essentially take the issue of abortion out of the judicial realm and put it into the political realm, where the bodies that are most accountable to the people, state legislatures, will be able to rule or will be able to pass laws accordingly. Now, what will happen is there's a political solution here. If the left has a bad, if the left has a decision they don't like, what can they do? Well, they can work to elect candidates who support their position at the state level to pass laws that they agree with. That is a political solution. The Supreme Court returning that is simply taking the issue and putting it back into the political realm and reversing what they did before, which was a political decision.
Mike, also, what does it say, or maybe in your opinion, what do you see looking at it from afar, when the court decides ultimately, okay, they're going to hear a case? And sometimes, you know, I find myself licking my chops from a political geek position here, saying, boy, I can't wait to see what the court says on this. And they say, nah, we're not going to take that. We're going to let it stay at least for now. Does the court sometimes say, nah, you know what, let's let this lie? We should be a court of last resort on a lot of these thorny issues.
Absolutely. And that's, and I mean, if you really want to see, Justice Roberts has Chief Justice Roberts has really tried to take a minimalist position. And you did make the analogy about calling balls and strikes. He famously said that in his confirmation hearing. And he really has put his stamp on the court as it was configured, you know, before Justice Barrett took the seat. And when it was Ruth Bader Ginsburg was holding it, when it was a 5-4, you know, so-called 5-4 breakdown of conservatives versus progressives. And so you've seen a real minimalist position. In other words, he's tried to keep keep the court's decisions within a certain narrow framework. And that does entail what you were just talking about, not necessarily taking cases that the right or the left is really chomping at the bit for, and sometimes disappointing both sides. And as I just said, there are plenty of conservatives over the past 5 to 10 years who've been very disappointed with a lot of the Supreme Court decisions. So if they're political hacks for the Republicans, then you're telling me something that I just can't agree with.
Yeah, and the other thing, Mike O'Neill, and I guess is Mike O'Neill from the Landmark Legal Foundation, the whole scenario here, and maybe Mr. Biden knows in his heart he's never going to do it, but he wants to keep the left wing of his party, you know, right, happy and content. This whole thing about a commission looking into packing the court. You know, I tell people, Mike, when I talk about it on this show and others, you know, read history. FDR tried this, and it crashed and burned. And not only did it crash and burn, Mike O'Neill, but just the thought of it was a major kickstart to the conservative movement and the Republican Party at the time, which many people thought was on the ropes. And that really breathed new life into them when FDR was talking about loading the court up.
It did, but it is important to remember that a lot of those cases they were dealing with were the New Deal cases.
Yeah.
And it did. I will disagree a little bit, and I will put put a finer point on it, mm-hmm. in that you had, it's kind of the switch in time that saved the nine. That's the famous saying for it, is you had a lot of these New Deal cases that were getting struck down. He did put that pressure, that threat of expanding the court, and then you had cases kind of turn, and lo and behold, the court began to uphold those New Deal cases. So, but again, that ultimately, you know, as one swings one way, it swings the other way. That ultimately begot the conservative legal movement later on, you had the New Deal court, then you had the Warren court, the 50s and 60s, mm-hmm. then you had the legal conservative movement really rise up and say, hey, we have to have a throwback, we have to get back to our roots, and that's originalism and textualism, and that's really what's kind of taken over now. And you see that even with liberal judges, you'll see that they always want to say, we're going to start with the text of the statute or with the text of the Constitution. So yeah, you will see the pendulum swinging on both ways. But I do agree with your point about him having this commission out there to kind of satisfy his liberal base and to actually kind of have it hanging out there. You know, I think that the court hears everything, and they read articles, and they're human beings just like the rest of us.
Mm-hmm.
So they, when they see this and have this hanging over their head, you know, it's just another thing for them to think about.
Finally, Michael O'Neill, from the Landmark Legal Foundation, will the liberals in this country, are they ever going to learn to stop telling the left-leaning justices when to retire? That, God rest her soul, Ruth Bader Ginsburg wanted to stay there, and she did. And now I think it's what? They're on Stephen Breyer's case to get out, right?
Absolutely. I mean, That is a fool's errand. You're not going to, no matter how much screaming and yelling you're going to, anybody's going to do, right or left, for calls for these individuals to retire. They're going to retire when they're good and ready. They've earned the spots. Those are the highest prestigious positions in the legal world. Those individuals have earned their right to stay there for life, and nothing screaming pundits or the left or the right's going to do is going to move them off those positions.
I've always thought, Mike, that I can imagine when, and we forget they're human beings. You know, I've read a bunch of things where, oh my God, how could Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Antonin Scalia have been such good friends? Well, they both loved opera, and they're human beings, and they didn't let that interfere with their friendship. But you know, Mike, I must sit there. They must laugh sometimes when they're discussing this. They're in a chamber and they're discussing a case. Hey, Steve, look who wants you to step down. You know, are you retired? I can imagine. I'd love to be a fly on the wall in those discussions.
You're not alone. I think there's many lawyers throughout the country that would love to be flies on walls and listen to those discussions as well to get an insight into what actually goes on. And when you have the curtain pulled back a little bit, we all find it fascinating about the deliberations regarding all these high-profile cases.
Michael O'Neill, Mike, thank you. Michael is the Assistant General Counsel and the Barbara K. Olson Legal Counsel at the Landmark Legal Foundation. Folks, check out Michael's writings and Landmark on the web, landmarklegal.org. Michael, good to speak with you. We'll chat down the road. Thanks.
Thank you, Paul. Bye-bye.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye. There you go, folks. I want to give you a little insight there in the Supreme Court. Yeah, they must. Now, remember, the Supreme Court, you know, everybody says, oh, the nine justices, the left and right and liberal, but they have to work together. See, that's fascinating. When they hear these oral arguments and they read all these amicus briefs and they hear the testimony and there's the protesters outside, can you imagine what they must say when they're, you know, how are they going to vote? They go in that chamber, the doors are shut. You know, their clerks may be standing by if they need help, or they want their clerk to pull a previous case to check precedent. But can you imagine what the nine of them must look at each other and talk? They crack jokes. Of course they do. Come on. You know that, you know, Sotomayor must say something to Clarence Thomas, say, boy, that guy gave that. What a blowhard answer you got on that question. You know what I mean? They're humans. So all this saber-rattling, finger-waving, all of these threats for Facebook led by Senator Blumenthal and WhatsApp and Instagram and TikTok, is any of this going to make a difference? We've had her on once before. We welcome back Quinnipiac University Associate Professor of Media Studies Kirsten Wesner to chime in on all of this. Professor, hi, it's Paul again at WICC. How are you?
Hi, thank you so much for having me on today.
Appreciate it. Good to have you back. Well, you've been seeing, Professor, what's floating around in D.C., and we had the whistleblower for sending stuff to the Wall Street Journal, and then the sit-down with Scott Pelley on Sunday night. Yeah, what's your long view on this? What do you think? Because you're surrounded by, you know, college people who are attached to their phones all day. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I don't know that they're attached to Facebook, but yes. So when Frances Haugen gave her testimony, it's been characterized as this big tobacco moment of truth, and that somehow, you know, she talked about how Facebook has been prioritizing revenue over the mental health of young women on Instagram. But we've seen all of this before with Facebook, so I don't know that we learned too much that was new from her testimony. We had access to some of this information back in 2018 with the Cambridge Analytica scandal. So Facebook has been repeatedly in hot water for its privacy violations with how it handles disinformation on the platform. So if anything, her testimony to me just reinforced that it has habitually been a bad actor. So, again, you know, lots of companies prioritize profit over information flow. I'm looking at YouTube or other social media platforms that do this.
And they talk, Professor, about, you know, uniting the world and letting us communicate. But you said it. These are advertising companies. They're publicly traded companies. I mean, I'm sure millions of people have Facebook shares in their portfolio.
Absolutely. And, you know, as we're looking at, you know, the senators were very upset by some of the information that they said was revealed during this testimony. For example, the brutal information about the mental health of young women on Instagram and the increase in suicidal thoughts when people are, you know, accessing Instagram. But the problem is how to regulate around any of this. And so, you know, again, this is reigniting calls for regulation. They've been around for years, but there's an inherent problem in doing this, and that's if we are going to let the government regulate regulate disinformation on Facebook, then we're basically saying that the government becomes the arbiter of truth. And the First Amendment exists to protect us from government intervention into our speech. Now, there are ways to regulate Facebook, but when we do it, we also have to stay mindful of those boundaries of the First Amendment.
So this is the kind of, Professor, the ultimate catch-22 here. You don't want garbage going out that most people know is patently wrong, but who actually says, and look, we all know that Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, they have people that sit there and look at garbage all day and censor a lot of it, but you're right, does the government have any role here?
You know, I think they do. And the thing is, so much of our conversation has been about how to regulate the speech on Facebook. But I think Facebook is just a symptom of a much bigger problem of how we control disinformation generally. So some of that responsibility will go in the hands of users and corporations, you know, as far as like building media literacy and teaching people that Facebook is an algorithm, you know, it's based on its model, its success hinges on outrage and on engagement, not on truth. So, you know, Facebook has an oversight board that's independent in helping them make decisions about policies that they should be implementing. But I think a lot of our conversation has been about free speech online. Instead, I think it makes sense when we're talking about regulation to look at Facebook as a data aggregator and start talking about those data collection practices that drive Facebook's algorithms and that are resulting in the proliferation of disinformation.
Okay, and it's fortuitous to have you on today, Professor, because you have a piece running in the Hearst, Connecticut media sites. Now, we, you know, our top of the hour news, bottom of the hour news here, all the networks have been talking about Matt Amodio, the guy from Yale, who's won like, $80 million or something like that on Jeopardy so far. But wait a minute. I see a piece here by Kirsten Wesner. Matt Amodio would probably beat me on Jeopardy, but my team beat him at bar trivia in Connecticut. Okay, what happened here? You tell us.
So I've always been a lifelong trivia fan, a lifelong Jeopardy fan. And when I came to Quinnipiac, I joined a trivia team with some of my colleagues here. And we played, you know, before the pandemic, we played weekly at the Playwright in Hamden, Connecticut.
Sure.
And one of the teams we played against was Matt Amodio's trivia team. And they're good. We didn't win against them often, but we have won against them several times. And so the piece today was about our experience playing Matt Amodio's team at the Playwright.
So did they talk trash, or were they all business, or or were they taunting you? Like, was Amodio Mr. Quiet? What do you remember about this?
I remember him being extremely brilliant, which shows during his Jeopardy run. Anyone who's watching it, it's undeniable. He is a force to be reckoned with on the Jeopardy stage. I think there's always some trash talking at the tables. And I know when my teammates and I went to the Playwright and we knew that the Rogue Scholars, his team, would be playing that night.
Wow.
we knew that we had our work cut out for us. And when we finally beat them, it was very enjoyable. I will admit to that. So we kind of used them as the arbiter for how we were doing. And we felt like we were doing well when we could compete well against them.
Nice. That's very cool. And you point out that you never actually have tried out for Jeopardy. Well, Professor, I actually did about 15 years ago at one of the casinos. I forget whether it was Foxwoods or Mohegan Sun. Can I tell you something? It was one of the single most humiliating days in my life. It did not.
Oh, no.
It did not. Yeah, I mean, look, I sat down and I said, well, okay, these questions are either going to be really easy to get rid of the real dopes first, or they're going to be really hard. They were really hard. That's just me. Time has escaped. Quinnipiac University Associate Professor of Media Studies, Kirsten Wesner. Professor, good to talk to you again. We'll chat down the road. Thanks.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye. And, folks, I will post her column about her trivia team going up against Mr. Jeopardy, Matt Amodio, and our Facebook page, facebook.com/WICC600.